Good afternoon, and welcome to another edition of Coffee Talk. Michael?
Fadi, once again, it's a pleasure to be here. You know, our listeners have spoken resoundingly, and they have helped make Coffee Talk the most popular podcast offered by the NATO Association of Canada. And I say we give them more of what they're looking for. So I say,
absolutely.
Let's talk.
Let's talk, Michael. Let's absolutely talk. I'm here with, my name is Fadi Dawood. I'm here with Michael Lumbers, one of our senior research fellows here at the NATO Association of Canada. One of three senior research fellows of the NATO Association
of Canada.
Exclusive
company.
Yeah, very much so. Michael and I are two, and our fellow research fellow is Eric Morris. So we're in good company, Michael.
We are.
I'm here with Emerson Marie and Ada Wahbi, who are both here as program editors, and we are going to speak about immigration today.
Why not?
Absolutely. So, how are you doing, guys?
Great.
I'm doing just fine.
Yeah, how are you?
Well, we are well.
Seeing you.
Awesome.
We came back.
Likewise.
We haven't done this in a long while. We're, you know, just
our
ready
listeners,
to talk.
We've been inundated with emails. People have been saying, when are you going to give us a new edition of Coffee Talk? Well, you know what? The wait has ended. We're here to do some coffee talk for you.
Let's do it then.
Yeah.
Okay, so immigration, borders, movements. We've done an edition on this, particularly the height of the refugee crisis a few months ago. But I think we have to revisit the topic, especially in light of having an event on open borders and immigration in Europe at the end of this week, on Thursday evening.
I think it's going to be of interest to all of our listeners.
What time is it? Please remind us again.
It's at 5:30 on Wednesday.
Oh, it's on Wednesday. Well, I'm correct.
Oh,
I stand corrected.
So that's quite soon then.
Okay.
Yes.
Where is it?
It'll be at the Hart House at the University of Toronto.
So anybody and everybody, you are more than welcome to go attend that event.
Please let's
make sure that the room is packed.
Yeah.
Yes.
Fadi and I will be there to sign autographs.
Absolutely. With our pictures, of course. And we are willing to take pictures with ladies and gentlemen out there.
Yeah.
We
don't forget our roots. We know where we came from.
Yes. We came from this particular office before we, made it big.
Struck it big, yeah.
Anyway, so let's talk about Coffee Talk and the topic at hand. Immigrations, border security. Michael, I'll start with you just for a moment. What do you think? I mean, we look at the refugee crisis at the moment. We look at the problems with the immigration. We look at the battles, between the right and left on the issue. And how do you see? I mean, you're a specialist of American foreign policy. How do you see this from the perspective of your specialty? How do you see this from the perspective of Americans? What have they done?
Well, this is an issue that is currently playing itself in the ongoing presidential election. Even just as recently as yesterday, Donald Trump, in an attempt to inject some seriousness into the election. He's now trying to deliver policy-laden speeches. Yesterday was another effort at such one. This one focusing on ISIS, and he's clearly immigration was cited in the speech as an area that needs to be dealt with. He seems to be trying to backpedal somewhat from his initial suggestion last fall of a ban on Muslim immigration. Now it's banning immigration from those countries that have been compromised by terrorism. But I mean, this opens up a whole lot of interesting questions which he did not address. I mean, if one were to take Donald at his word, you might actually suggest that people from Germany and France, which are hotbeds of terrorism in terms of people from terrorism groups planning and executing terrorist attacks in those countries, does that mean you start banning people from France and Germany to come into the U.S.? These are questions that he didn't really
address,
and I don't expect him to. I think he likes leaving it sufficiently ambiguous to throw red meat at his supporters, but without actually addressing the specifics. So this is an issue that's playing itself out. obviously we can talk about in this edition of Coffee Talk, we can talk about this issue as it pertains to any country or region.
Well, I mean, I just wanted to get the American perspective and the European perspective on this issue and just sort of to compare and contrast.
Yeah.
Because particular places like Germany, where they have opened their borders to refugees and mass migration, there are certainly obstacles to having that many people coming into a place like Germany.
Plus you also have many countries within the EU who aren't crazy about this approach.
No. While you have the United Kingdom with just, I mean, part of the larger part of the reason, which, by the way, I should do a plug-in for one of the previous coffee talks that we've done. We did a coffee talk on the Brexit, so I would encourage you to go and visit it.
Yeah. We got a lot of listeners for
that. Yes, we did. So just on that issue, on refugees and refugee crisis in Europe, who can comment on that? Emerson, would you like to comment on it first? Or
I actually think Layla with her event tomorrow.
Okay.
Well, I think it's just interesting looking at how, the reason why this topic needs to be revisited is looking at how this has impacted Europe itself, and especially the European Union, in light of Brexit, in light of looking at how this has almost created like an east-west divide between Europe. And I think it's just really interesting to see how you have some states that are advocating for this burden sharing, but then you also see the complete opposite of other states who are pretty much advocating for putting in like a certain quota system and such, and putting in their own laws or own system into how they are going to accommodate migrants coming in and such. So in a way, you kind of also see that there's a struggle between whether this is a nationalist issue, whether these states should be dealing with these on their own, or this should be kind of answered by the European Union as a whole collective entity. So it's interesting to see on
that's opened up a fault line within the EU. It's certainly it's one of the, as if there aren't enough issues to consume the EU's attention. Immigration is certainly one of them.
Now, Australia is another. You had mentioned Australia previously today.
Well, I think actually in the case of both Canada and Australia. So when we talk about, Canada's or Canadian government, Trudeau administration's, more positive attitude towards Syrian refugees, I think developments in the past few days highlight a very important part of the Canadian immigration system that often goes unnoticed, and that is our immigration detention system. Within the white settler states, Canada, Australia, United States, these very much immigration detention very much is symbolic or indicative of the fact that institutional racism remains a factor. And I think that's when we look at immigration detention, we start to ask, okay, what do borders serve? What does visa restrictions? What does security measures? Who do they serve, who do they keep in, and who do they keep out? So it was recently announced by the Ministry of Public Safety that Canada would be going through immigration detention reform, so trying to make the conditions more livable for detainees.
He also mentioned, Ralph Gale mentioned, the building of new detention centers.
Building
of
new detention centers, being more cognizant of the detainment time periods for detention. And I think when we're talking about immigration and the refugee crisis, we need to be very conscious of this other aspect. Because we can think, look at these benevolent Western countries accepting refugees, etc. But, this dynamic really puts that into question. So, beforehand, you had about, I think, between 2004 and 2000, or a couple years ago, it had said there had been 80,000 people detained within Canada's immigration detention system, and this is a bipartisan problem. It, has been grown under the Liberal government and the Conservative government. Not only that, but being detained in provincial prisons, maximum security prisons, not for being convicted criminals, violating the immigration... What is the act? But essentially, violating immigration law is not a criminal act. These are not criminal convictions. They're deemed flight risk, etc. But why are they being made to undergo, maximum security imprisonment? And I think, this is a step forward, but asking how do we detain people more nicely?
Mm-hmm.
How do we, you know, ensure that the conditions of their detainment are nicer, I think that, you know, misses the mark. It's why do we have these systems in place, and what do they serve?
Well, actually, this makes me think of Max Weber's
mm-hmm.
sort of definition of the state, and the state having the sole legitimacy of using violence as a form of control
mm-hmm.
and mass control of populations. And this goes to the heart of that issue.
In Australia, you know, we've seen over the past couple of weeks increasing revelations about the conditions of immigration detention camps at Nauru, Papua New Guinea.
Mm.
You know, sexual abuse, you know, starvation, etc., depression. And I think it really hints, you know, how is it that these sorts of living conditions are acceptable in a country that is supposed to be developed? And then you look, you know, who is entitled to democratic rights and who is not. Australia, you know, since about 2000 has been engaging in a process of excising certain areas of its, you know, territory from what is called the legal migration zone. So people who do not arrive in the legal migration zone can be, it's a very technical process, but if you arrive by boat in Australia now, you will not be resettled in Australia. The Australian government has made that very clear through different PR campaigns, you know, very gloomy images of ships and such. And so they're being sent to these, you know, Pacific Islands, you know, Papua New Guinea, Nauru, in detention camps operated by the respective governments there rather than the Australian government, and also spending about $55 million Australian dollars on a deal with Cambodia to resettle migrants there.
Was immigration an issue in the recent Australian election, or did this?
It's been an issue there since about
the 2000s.
It's been an
issue since I recall a time when the Australian they had an election and sort of the Conservative Liberal Party, I believe it's called
John Howard.
When John Howard became Prime Minister, he actually stopped the process of people who had actually even applied as legal immigrants under the point system
mm-hmm.
in Australia. And he made the threshold higher, and everybody who had actually previously met the threshold, had applied to immigrate to Australia, had reached a point of essentially just waiting visas. He stopped those visas and essentially wrote them and told them, you are no longer welcome in Australia.
Yeah.
So it's an issue that has been ongoing for a long time now, since actually the mid-90s, early 2000s.
People are arriving by boat because air travel is expensive. Australian embassies around the world are overloaded with visa applications, and they cannot wait.
Yeah.
You know. I don't know. Do you, Layla, have much input on what detention systems are like in Europe?
For Europe, I think just looking at, like, the treatment of, like, mainly asylum seekers coming
mm-hmm.
in right now, an interesting
yeah.
point, like, looking at the treatment of them coming in. For example, in Denmark, recently, a few months ago, they've actually been collecting valuables from these asylum seekers. I mean, these are people who have left with pretty much nothing, only whatever they can take on them. And arriving there, Danish authorities have actually been collecting their valuables and such in order to help, as assets to help for their stay. While there,
the cost, right?
So yeah, to cover any costs and such. But I think it's interesting to look at because you kind of have to look at where do you
mm-hmm.
draw the line based on in order to help accommodate these people, but as well looking at how do you fund it? Like where does that come from?
I mean, the thing is like even why are we asking the question how do you accommodate them today? Whereas, you know, realistically, countries like France and the UK have been having to accommodate.
Do you even accommodate?
Since, you know, the Second World War.
Yes.
You know, this has been a decade-long process. Especially, I mean, I use the French example just because it's a very interesting one. You know, talking about, you know, the banlieue, sort of the suburbs, the immigrant
mm-hmm. yeah.
neighborhoods in France.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we're sitting there, like, shaking your heads, wondering, okay, what do we do now? But, you know, Algerians, for example, you know, North Africans have been coming to France since, you know, not only before the wartime period, but in the post-war period, so the 50s and 60s.
Don't forget, Algeria and other places in North Africa were considered French territory.
Mm-hmm. The
so these
legacy.
People,
mm-hmm.
so
yeah.
these people would
mm-hmm.
come to, you know, France as essentially part as subjects of the
mm-hmm.
French Empire. So I'm always surprised that these people, these communities, are left to essentially wallow in poverty, in marginalization, in discrimination, And so these problems are not coming out of nothing. These problems have to be contextualized.
Especially the 1980s when you had the defunding of immigrant housing services targeted at those communities. I think that's where you saw a lot of the material disparities grow between native white French people and the migrant communities in the banlieue. Aside from the fact that France, too, for a long time, has had a policy of colorblindness. So, you know, if we don't see race, then there won't be racism. I think they removed from its laws a couple years ago the word race from its laws to, you know, apparently be an anti-racist endeavor. But if you can't confront the racial inequality and the racial injustices that arise due to prevailing white supremacy, you know, you're not really going to get to the bottom of things. And so I think you have to place the question now, you know, what do you do to all these migrants, that historical context.
Mm-hmm.
And you bring that, you know, colonial legacies, et cetera.
And I think that what makes it even
yeah.
more difficult is with the huge influx coming in, mainly from Middle Eastern countries such as Iraq and Syria, economic migrants,
mm-hmm.
such as in North
yeah.
Africa, are actually being turned away now that they're even struggling just to enter
mm-hmm.
Europe. Because
yeah.
now you see that there's a selectivity based on, well,
yeah.
who needs this most?
Actually, it's very interesting how the French government facilitated the mass migration of certain groups of people that were displaced from Mosul after 2014 from northern Iraq. So they had planes that actually went into northern Iraq and carried individuals to France. But those people, some of them, have returned back to Iraq because despite the fact that they were welcomed by the French government in a legal way, they actually found living in France to be too oppressive.
Mm-hmm.
Too much for
mm-hmm.
them. So it's very interesting. The French model has clearly essentially failed. I would say that the French model has failed for all intents and purposes. Now, what is the best model? I don't really know, but...
Yeah, is there actually a successful
model? A successful model, I don't know. I don't really know. I mean, you look at Germany, and there are these Turkish mass migrants that
mm-hmm.
came to Germany two or three generations ago, and they still are struggling to become part
yeah,
of society.
Well,
they
the
are...
Canadian isn't,
oh no, the Canadian
know,
model is far from perfect. Absolutely not.
Yeah.
I mean, Canada, we should confront
yeah.
the issues. I mean, the problem in Canada, I think, we have the same problem as France. We do not want to confront the race issues
mm-hmm.
and the race divides that are.
Yeah.
I mean, outside of the big cities, you have very much, very visible racism. You have issues of race relation tensions in Canada. And not only against immigrant populations, but Aboriginal communities, too.
Well, just look at the poverty rate. So the proportion of impoverished white Canadians to what their share of the population is, and the proportion of racialized Canadians who are impoverished compared to their share of the population. It's double for racialized Canadians in every province, and triple in Quebec.
That's a sobering statistic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And Quebec is another problem. That's a whole, because they have their own immigration
yep.
system
yes.
and their own quotas and
mm-hmm.
their own, you know,
and
language barriers.
Detention. Again, as we come back to that, the
yeah.
deaths of 10 people since, I think, 2000. I think that's what the statistics is often brought up by the migrant rights groups in Canada.
It's very interesting to look at all of this
mm-hmm.
and try to come to terms with it.
Yeah.
But really, it's clear that regardless of where you look, there are pitfalls. But at least in a place like Canada, and it will have to, you come in, even as a refugee, and if you are accepted as a refugee through the United Nations programs or through private sponsorship, you come to Canada and you live in society. You do not live in these separate camps necessarily. You actually start building your life the moment you arrive. The problem with European, asylum seekers, they reach a place, be it Germany or France or Holland or whatever, and they live in these refugee camps and they can wallow in these places for 2-3 years at a time. Until
they're essentially
segregated.
Yeah.
They live separately. They live in horrid conditions until they are allowed to live as part of society. So, I mean, imagine living for 4 years in limbo and not really having a legal status in the country you're seeking asylum in.
Yeah.
It's horrible. So there are positives to every system and every place we're looking at, and I think there should be some sort of consensus that we can come up with, which sounds very ideal and very utopian.
Maybe a consensus will be reached at this event tomorrow that we're hosting.
Maybe.
You never know.
Well, I think what makes it extremely difficult, especially for the EU, is trying to decide based on, like, how should this be addressed? Like, should this be redressed as a whole collective EU response, or should countries decide on their own on how to respond to this. And I think what also makes it even more difficult is you have migrants trying to get to example, Germany, which has more of an open-door policies. But in order to get there, you have to go through Hungary and such, who have essentially closed their borders. So they just end up almost stuck in where they enter from.
Well, I think it's an issue that we will keep talking about in the near future and maybe even, sadly, the long term. Particularly with a lot of mass turmoil.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I mean, we haven't even touched upon the Middle East itself. Jordan, Turkey, other places where they are receiving mass amounts of... I mean, Jordan is a tiny little country, and it's received, you know, millions of people from Iraq and Syria as refugees.
Well, when you think, I mean, in terms of a proportion of Jordan's population, what the last few years, what they've taken in from Syria and Iraq, I mean, it's staggering.
It is.
And Jordan is overburdened.
And Jordan is a poor country, as is.
Yeah.
So.
The figure that really, you know, when people, Canadians or Europeans, are complaining about migration refugees, just remember that 80% of the world's refugees are taken in developing countries.
Yeah, and they're taken in neighboring countries.
Yeah.
You know, in neighboring countries, be it in Africa or the Middle East, but the focus is currently on the Middle East.
And I remember last year when the Obama administration announced that they were taking in 10,000 from
Syria.
There was this hue and outcry.
Yeah, and I remember Ted Cruz and Bush and others, you know, making a huge outcry in November about it.
And I mean, 10,000 is peanuts compared to what we're talking about elsewhere.
We're talking, and even when Canada took 25,000 Syrian refugees.
Yeah.
I mean, in proportion to the amount of people displaced in Syria and in the European Union, it's staggering amounts of people.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, millions of people have been displaced from Syria. And I will say this much, we do have a responsibility towards these people because, you know, they are, for all intents and purposes, we have a responsibility. I mean, for the individuals that are essentially homeless at the moment and without actually really a fault of their own.
Yeah.
Anyway, on that sad note, I will have to end this edition of Coffee Talk.
Mm-hmm.
We are reminding you that tomorrow at Hart House at 5:30, there is an event on open borders and European immigration policy.
That's Wednesday, August the 17th.
2016.
Yes.
And for those of you who have been listening, thank you very much. We do appreciate your phone calls, your emails, your fan mail.
We are nothing without the support of our many loyal listeners. And both Fadi and I can guarantee you that we have many, many, many more Coffee Talks to come. And we appreciate your continued support. And all I can say is the best is yet to come.
Thank you for listening for another edition of Coffee Talk.